morning and ask you to open your Bible this morning, Gospel of Luke, chapter 22, Luke 22. I want to read a familiar story close to the time in Jesus' life that Scott was just reading to us from before we partook of the Lord's Supper. And as the screen alludes to right there, we want to talk about Judas this morning. Luke chapter 22 is the gospel that I want to read from, and we will by and large stay right here this morning. In Luke 22, I'll allude to a couple of other places. But Luke 22 is where you're going to want to be. We're going to work through this story and think through it for all its familiarity. Some things that maybe we have not always thought about and certainly not applied to ourselves. Luke chapter 22, it is, of course, the Passover. It is the Passover season. It is a patriotic time of year in Israel in general and Jerusalem in particular. The keeping of the Passover, it of course, looks back to God delivering his people from the oppression of Egypt. And by the first century AD, in the days of Jesus, the keeping of the Passover reminded the Jews of God's promise of yet another deliverer, a Messiah, who would come and deliver them from their troubles. And so then Jesus, by this point in the story, Jesus for the past several years has been raising everybody's hopes and expectations. He's the guy. He's the one that finally another prophet like unto Moses has come and is going to deliver God's people. And so the question on the table in one sense is he the Messiah or is he not? Is he the coming deliverer or is he not? And even over the course of his ministry, that question has been raised. Jesus has asked his disciples at one point, who do men say that I am? And Peter issued that famous confession. You are the Christ. You're the Messiah. You're the Son of God. John the Baptist has sent messengers once upon a time asking, are you the guy or not? I mean, this has been swirling around Jesus for several years now. And so here we are. It is Passover season, otherwise known as the Feast of Unleavened Bread, as I begin reading in verse 1 this morning. The Passover season, and that's where we pick up our story. Now, the Feast of Unleavened Bread drew near, which is also called Passover. The chief priests and the scribes were seeking how to put him to death, for they feared the people. And so Satan entered Judas, who was also called Iscariot, who was of the number of the 12. And he went away, and he conferred with the chief priests and the officers how he might betray him being Jesus, to them. And they were glad, so they agreed to give him money. And so he consented, and he sought an opportunity to betray him to them in the absence of a crowd. And so the leaders of Jerusalem are in a predicament. The leaders hate Jesus, but the people love Jesus. And so they've got a problem. They fear the people. They don't want an uproar. I mean, this is a time of year when extra people are packed in Jerusalem because it's the feast season. And I want you to think about something this morning as we see Judas entering into the great act of betrayal is this. The thing about Judas that I want you to understand this morning as we enter into this story for all its familiarity, the thing about Judas is that he's only obvious as a traitor in hindsight now. As we go through this story and think about this familiar story this morning, I hope that becomes even more clear. It's only obvious in hindsight now what a treacherous man he was. And because the thing is, as long as Judas's name remains a byword for betrayal and sin and depravity, the thing is, as long as Judas just looks evil, and so obviously so, then that means he doesn't look like me. That means he's different than me, and what he does is different than what I have done or am capable of doing. The thing is, as long as Judas is just considered one of history's worst monsters outright, and we fail to look at how ordinary he was, how invisible he was, how unobvious he was at the time of the great betrayal, one of history's greatest monsters, then we don't see him or see ourselves in him. We don't see the potential to act like him within ourselves. You understand that this morning? And so it's very important that we, as we enter into this story, the fact of the matter is Judas at that point is not obviously the traitor. And I hope that will again become more clear as we go on. Because as long as he just looks evil, he does not look like me. I want you to notice there, as we're introduced to the story, that it points out he is one of the 12. Now, yes, on one level, that can underscore the level of betrayal, that he was one of Jesus's inner circle. We forget sometimes that Jesus had an entourage that followed him around. The 12 were selected out of that entourage. There were women who supported him. Rich widows and things like that. He had an entourage. He doesn't go into Jerusalem alone. He goes in with a crowd. And so Judas therefore is one of the 12. He has been handpicked by Jesus himself. You remember that story earlier in the Gospels? Luke 6 is one version of it. When Jesus goes up on the mountain, prays all night, and then what does he do? He comes out and he picks 12. We sing the song sometimes. We sing it to our kids. Jesus named them one by one, Peter, Andrew, James, and John. And who's in that list? Judas, intentionally chosen by the Lord. Listen, if you're looking for a traitor in Jesus' circle, you're not looking at one of the 12, because Jesus, the guy who knows all people and knows all things, surely he's not going to pick the guy who would try to destroy him as one of his inner circle, would he? If you're looking for a betrayal, you're looking for the new guy who just joined the entourage last week. You're looking for that guy whose name you can't remember, that guy who's kind of got a little funny looking grin on his face the whole time, right? That's the guy you're looking for. Not one of the 12. Not only that, but Luke chapter 9 reminds us that in the limited commission, Jesus sent them out. And do you understand this morning? That when Jesus sends the 12 out, he gave them power and authority over demons and the ability to heal diseases. And so they went out and they went through the villages preaching the gospel and healing everywhere. You understand that included Judas? You understand that this morning? You understand that Judas once went through the villages of ancient Israel proclaiming the coming kingdom of God in the name of Jesus. You understand that Judas used to cast out demons. You understand that Judas healed people of their diseases. He was granted that power, that authority, and he spoke that message. If you're looking for the guy to betray Jesus, he's not the obvious one. Oh, in hindsight now, yeah, we see it coming. But at the time, folks, he looks just like you and me, maybe a little bit better. Maybe he looks like he has a stronger faith. I mean, after all, Jesus handpicked him. Jesus has got an eye for leadership potential. Jesus knows something about faith. Oh, ye of little faith, he'll say sometimes to people. Not only that, but he was highly trusted in the group. John's gospel adds this detail that he was the keeper of the feast, or excuse me, the keeper of the bag. He was the treasurer of the group. You don't trust a guy who just got out of prison after serving 10 years for embezzlement with a checkbook. Now, yes, in hindsight, we know that Judas was a thief. The Gospels will make that clear, but that's the whole point. Nobody knew it at the time. It wasn't obvious. Otherwise, guess what? On the night Jesus is betrayed in John chapter 13, at the Last Supper itself, when Judas says to Judas, what you do quickly. John's gospel says no one of those who were reclining at the table with him knew why Jesus had said this to him. Some thought because Judas had the money box that Jesus was basically saying to him, go buy the things we need for the feast so that he should go give something to the poor. And so when Judas went out the door that night, guess what? None of the other 11 thought anything of it. Why? Because Judas is the guy with the checkbook. This is what he does. He goes out and he pays the bills or gives the alms or whatever you have. And so when he goes out that night from the upper room, do you understand that this morning? None of the other 11 suspected anything was amiss. Why? Because they trusted Judas. Of course, again, we now know that he was actually living a double life the whole time, because it is still John's gospel who points out that Judas was a thief, not really concerned about the poor. But he used to pilfer what was put in it. Oh, it came out in hindsight after he was dead and people were wondering what happened and they audited the accounts and realized it's not all there. But at the time, Judas was living a double life. Literally up until the night Jesus is betrayed, nobody thinks anything of it. On the outside, Judas is walking the walk, doing great things, saying great things in a position of trust and prominence in the 12. Yeah, we may put him last in the list now, but I bet you he wasn't last in the list then. Not the guy who's holding the checkbook, a known figure in public, the guy who hands out alms in the names of Jesus. Folks, again, though, the part of the point this morning is to understand he's not history's greatest monster, obviously walking around at that time. We see him that way in hindsight. Folks, he looks a lot like, or he could look just a lot like you or me at the time. Here's Judas after all these years of listening to Jesus, and he's still got a price. He's still got a point at which he will compromise. He's still got a level at which he will sell out to the world and to those who make the world's opinions, those who determine what's cool and what's not, those who decide what's sophisticated and intelligent and what's ignorant. And so Judas goes to those who want Jesus destroyed, and he says, let's make a deal. Luke's account doesn't say this, but Matthew's account adds that it was 30 pieces of silver, an amount often linked to the price of a mere slave, by all accounts, a small price to pay by rich men to get rid of a rival to their power, their influence, and the people's attention. Why did Judas do it? Well, greed, perhaps. Certainly, we know that he had a thing for money. Greed, perhaps. But maybe just as well, he was trying to force Jesus' hand, trying to start a revolution. Listen, we know from the Gospels that, in a sense, all of the 12 struggled to understand he was not here to start an earthly kingdom. He was not here to overthrow the Romans. And so maybe Judas thought by forcing Jesus into conflict directly with the rulers instead of sneaking around at night and hiding in upper rooms, that maybe the revolution could finally get going. I mean, after all, remember, it wasn't that long ago, chronologically in the story of the Gospel, that the mother of James and John is asking for the right and the left hand in the kingdom. Maybe Judas was just trying to grease the wheels of history a little bit. Everyone else in the group was still struggling to understand the implications of Jesus being a Messiah of a kingdom, not of this world. Why wouldn't Judas struggle to understand it as well? Why wouldn't Judas possibly be trying to force a confrontation between Jesus and the power structure, the corrupt power structure? Judas must have seen that, otherwise he wouldn't have followed Jesus at all. It's Passover season, great time to do it. And hey, if I got a thing for money, why not make a few bucks on the side anyways? After all, isn't that how it works in the kingdoms of men? It's a win-win situation for everybody. And so we go on in the story. So the day came of unleavened bread, on which the Passover lamb had to be sacrificed. So Jesus sent Peter and John, saying, "Go and prepare the Passover for us that we may eat it." And they said to him, "Where will you have us prepare it?" And he said to them, "Behold, when you have entered the city, a man carrying a jar of water will meet you. Follow him into the house that he enters. Tell the master of that house, 'The teacher says to you, where is the guest room? Where may I eat the Passover with my disciples?' And he will show you a large upper room furnished. Prepare it there." And so they went and they found it just as he had told them, and they prepared the Passover. And so here we go with the next step of the story. And what's important to notice here is Peter and John in contrast to Judas. Peter and John in contrast to Judas. Peter and John just need to follow Jesus' instructions and everything will work out just like it's supposed to be. They, if they will just obey Jesus, the instructions make no sense. Go around, look for a guy carrying a bunch of bottled water, we'd say today, and follow him wherever he goes and say, "Hey, Jesus needs the room." And I know people have commentators over the centuries and people today wrestle with, well, maybe Jesus had already set something up. They didn't know he was expecting them, etc. I don't know, and nobody knows for sure either. The point is, Jesus gave them clear instructions with a lot of obvious details missing as far as we can tell. And what was their job? Simply to do what they were told. And they would find it was just as he had told them if they would do so. That was their job, to follow the instructions even though they didn't make sense. Kind of like accepting when Jesus says, "My kingdom's not of this world," and it doesn't make any sense, but you just need to start listening and trying to understand it, even though it's not what you were looking for or you hoped for. All Peter and John needed to do was just follow Jesus' instructions, and everything would work out. Yet too often with us folks, in the heat of the moment, despite what our expectations and understandings are, when we have a crisis of faith, when what God asks us to do, the commandments and the attitudes and the actions that we are called to as Christians, we just need to do what God says in our lives rather than trying to ad-lib like maybe Judas was doing and trying to redirect history in a different place. Oh, Peter and John's actions look so very different from Judas's. They simply take very vague and odd instructions and do exactly as they are told, and it works out just as Jesus had said. Because the fact of the matter is, Satan had a plan. He was working to destroy Jesus. Satan had a plan. Did you catch that in verse 3? Satan entered into Judas. Oh, Judas cooperates, but Satan has a plan. He's trying to get to Jesus. The enemies of Jesus have a plan. They know how to get Jesus at a time and in a place where it seems otherwise impossible. The traitor has a plan. Judas has found a way to make a nickel off God, and yet Jesus himself has a plan that takes it all into account. And all he asks of his people is, he says, "Listen, I know what Satan's up to. I know what my enemies are thinking. I know what the weak and the vulnerable and the traitors among you are thinking. The rest of you just need to do what you were told. I've got this." God is still in control. Jesus knows what is going on. It's funny, at this point in the story, if we were to stop right here, everybody thinks they're winning. Everybody thinks they're going to get what they want out of life and out of this situation. The leaders think they're going to get rid of Jesus. Satan thinks he's got him cornered. Judas is making a buck and starting a revolution. Everybody's happy. But only one of them is actually right and truly understands the enormity of what's going on, and that's Jesus. And so we come to the third act and the final part in this story of betrayal. When the hour came. You notice how the story works, by the way. We start within that season at the beginning. And then the next section is at the time of the Passover. And then it becomes at the very hour. We keep on narrowing. And at that hour, he reclined at the table. The apostles are with him. He goes and he establishes what we call the Lord's Supper. But towards the end of that, he says, "Behold, the hand of him who betrays me is with me on the table. For the Son of Man goes as it has been determined, but woe to that man by whom he is betrayed." And I want you to notice something. The last line. "And they began to question one another which of them it could be who was going to do this." You know why they talked amongst themselves about it? Because it wasn't obviously going to be Judas. Nobody saw it coming. Even they didn't think it was Judas. When Jesus says, "One of you is going to betray me," it wasn't one of those awkward moments when all heads at the table turn and look at him, and he has to come up with some convenient lie or excuse. They're all looking at each other, and nobody has an idea, which is why it rattles all of them. Because again, if there's going to be a betrayal, it's not going to be one of the 12. It's going to be someone else in the entourage. It's going to be blind Bartimaeus. He just showed up at Jericho, and you know about those people from Jericho. Even at that final hour, it wasn't obviously going to be him. Let me make three quick observations from the story about what it means to see ourselves in Judas, to realize he was not the obvious traitor. Oh, in hindsight, it's clear as day now, isn't it? The history's full of 2020 relooks and do-overs. How could Julius Caesar not see it was going to be Brutus? Well, that's because Shakespeare's a great storyteller. It wasn't obvious at the time, folks, and that's why I think we need to look at the story of Judas with fresh eyes. I'm going to make three quick observations. We'll be through for our time together this morning. Number one, sin in general makes all of us traitors. Do you understand that this morning? Sin makes all of us traitors. Yes, I mean, Judas sinned in a particular way against Jesus. No doubt about that. He literally, and Jesus pronounces woe upon the one who would do this to me. But the fact of the matter is, folks, step number one this morning in seeing ourselves in Judas and like Judas and realizing any of us can become Judas is number one to understand that sin makes all of us traitors. We focus on Judas as a traitor, the worst of all human beings. When Dante writes his Inferno, his famous poem detailing a trip to hell and how God punishes sinners. Guess who's at the center of hell right next to Satan and Dante's telling? Guess who's there? Can you guess? It's Judas. Because he's history's greatest monster, the worst sin a human being can commit. And yet, when you stop and think about it, at the end of the day, there's still plenty of other people in Dante's Inferno and in the true living God's hell as well. Sin makes us all traitors. We focus on Judas as a traitor, but the fact of the matter is all sin betrays God because all sin betrays the image of God that he placed in us. All sin denies his purpose for man when he made mankind in his image and said, "Be fruitful and multiply and have dominion over the earth." All sin betrays God's image and God's purpose. You can single somebody else out who's worse than you on paper and make yourself feel better about it, but the fact of the matter is any sin, all sin, is in fact a betrayal of the Almighty and his purpose. We betray God and what he made us to be. We betray others who are hurt by our sin. Sometimes we focus just upon ourselves and not upon how what we do affects other people. How often has a man or a woman engaged in an affair without thinking about what it's going to do to their children when it comes out and they are caught? Sin has a ripple effect in which others who are minding their own business get hurt because of what I have done. They have been betrayed. They have been put in an awful situation. Even Judas, before he dies, comes to his senses and begins to realize that when in Matthew's account in chapter 27, when he sees that Jesus has been condemned to die, do you remember what he does? He goes back to the authorities. He tries to give the money back. But do you remember what he says most hauntingly? "I have betrayed what? Innocent blood." this did not go how I expected. Again, maybe Judas really was trying to make a buck on the side and also help start the revolution. He did not think Jesus would actually do nothing. I mean, listen, Judas has watched Jesus for years. Jesus squeaks out of all sorts of sticky situations. Jesus has power. Jesus can do stuff. Nobody ever gets a finger on Jesus. And to actually watch Jesus passively do nothing this time blew Judas's mind. This was not what he expected either. I have betrayed innocent blood. An innocent man is going to suffer because of what I have done. Folks, we've got to understand, number one this morning, sin makes all of us traitors. Number two, being on the team does not make you a teammate. Being on the team does not make you a teammate. Judas was one of the 12, folks, but he was on the team, but he was not a teammate. He was acting more like a free agent. You see this sometimes in professional sports, right? Some troubled players put on the roster, football, basketball, whatever. And what happens in the locker room? Chaos begins to break out. You put two superstars on the same team, and guess what? Somebody's not happy because only one person could get the ball the majority of the time. And so eventually, especially on NBA teams, something like this happens. You try to build a team, two or three superstars, so you can win the championship. But what happens? Egos gets in the way. Happens every era with every great team, it seems like. We could name names, but we're not going through this morning. Being on the team does not make you a teammate. Judas represents the disciple who is no disciple at all. He follows Jesus, but he does not truly follow Jesus. For years, he was just one of the 12, traveling where they went, hearing what they heard, seeing what they saw, receiving what they had received, whether it was teaching, whether it was authority, whether it was delegated ability to cast out demons and work miracles. And all of this reminds us, therefore, that even though Judas was on the team, he was not truly a teammate. He was not truly trying to become part of what Jesus was really doing. This all serves to remind every last one of us, folks, that we can be a Judas too. Church membership and association with a sound congregation alone are not the marks of salvation. And the fact that the elders never suspect it's you doesn't mean you're all right with God or you're on the right track. Just ask Matthew and James and John how shocked they must have been the day after that it was Judas, because nobody saw it coming. The fact of the matter is that you have to seek first his kingdom and his righteousness, Jesus himself says. You seek the kingdom and the righteousness first. Anything else is just tagging along with the team, but you're not really, truly part of the team. Do you understand that this morning? That was Judas's issue, and that can become us as well. And number three, quickly and finally, we need to remember the bigger picture. It goes all the way back to chapter 22 and verse 3. You still there? Chapter 22 and verse 3, Satan entered into him. Yes, that does not, by any stretch of the imagination, absolve Judas of his culpability. The fact of the matter is Satan found a willing tool in Judas Iscariot. But we've got to remember the bigger picture here. That sin is part of a cosmic problem, that we're caught up in something way, way bigger than you and me and our life and our time. It's the interest of Satan in getting involved in what is going on with Jesus. It is very clear that Satan wants Jesus dead. Satan wants Jesus thwarted. It's clear that Satan is at war with God and with Jesus, and that war is often fought against God and Jesus through getting humans to sin against God. Satan is the serpent in the garden getting Adam and Eve to eat forbidden fruit. Satan is there in the wilderness trying to get Jesus to take the easy way out and avoid the cross while still getting the crown. And Satan is there at this Passover, that year, in that place, still determined to destroy Jesus and using a willing Judas to get Jesus killed. And yet you and I both know the irony of this. That at that very moment, Satan unwittingly seals his own doom. Because just like the disciples did not understand all of Jesus' teaching at that time, Satan must not have understood what God had said to Adam and Eve back in the beginning. I will put enmity between the woman, your seed, and her seed. He shall bruise you on the head, and you shall bruise him on the heel. Just like it didn't turn out like Judas expected, it didn't turn out like Satan expected either. But here's the question for you and me as we begin to wrap up this morning. When it comes to sin, do you truly understand that you become a pawn of Satan and his rebellion against God and the war against the Creator? Do you understand that this morning? Just like Judas became a soldier of the darkness without ever truly realizing the enormity of what he had gotten caught up in. He just thought he was going to try to start a revolution, try to help Jesus get over his humility and his hesitance to declare himself king and get this thing going. Did not realize that what he was really doing was joining in Satan's rebellion against all of God's created reality. with sin, do you truly understand that when you sin, you're just like Judas, you become a pawn in Satan's rebellion against God? And do you understand this morning that just as Judas did not understand, and as Satan failed to understand, that in this rebellion, you don't actually in fact destroy God or Jesus, you just destroy yourself and hurt a lot of other people along the way. You understand that this morning? Oh, it's so easy to say Judas is different than me, and I would never do that. But the fact of the matter is, folks, we can be just like Judas when you understand that all sin is a betrayal. That being on the team does not make you a teammate. And that ultimately we're called up in something much bigger than ourselves. This is a cosmic struggle which Satan leads the way. And so if you're in sin this morning, you're a pawn of Satan. If you've bought into the lie that you have to have fun and enjoyment and freedom by doing your life your way instead of God's this morning, listen, you're no different than Judas. The sins may be different when listed out legally speaking, but you're no different. Adam and Eve lost the garden because they didn't understand this. Judas was destroyed from the inside out, and Satan, the architect of it all, was ironically shown to be utterly inept as he unintentionally gave God the ultimate victory at the cross, even though he thought he was defeating God by killing Jesus. Don't make the same foolish mistake this morning. Understand. Don't be Judas and think that you're doing something better or different than God's way. Humble yourself like Peter and John. Just do what you're told. Follow God. He's got this under control. Everyone else thought they were in control in that story. And it became an absolute disaster for human beings who were involved. Woe, Jesus says, to the one by whom I am betrayed. If that's you this morning, we'd like to help you with that. If you need to obey the gospel of Jesus Christ and get on the team in the first place, we want to help you with that. If you're ready to confess Jesus as Lord, Savior, Son of God, repent of your place in the world and the sins you've committed, we'll baptize you for the forgiveness of those sins this morning. If you're a child of God already, but you recognize that like Judas, you've been harboring maybe some secret sin, maybe you're not as fully committed, maybe you've not been doing it God's way, you've been trying to, like Judas, improve upon the plan and the timeline. Pray to God for forgiveness of whatever it is that you've been involved in. We'd be happy to hold you accountable, to pray with you and for you, if you'll share that with us right now while we stand, while we sing.